from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Our universe is not quite what we thought. A huge new study says it's 100 million years older, that it's lopsided, that it's got more dark matter and less dark energy than we knew, and that it's expanding more slowly than we thought. New data from the European Space Agency's Planck mission is changing the way we understand the shape and stuff of the universe. We're dipping in. This hour on Point, our cosmos and what we now know. You can join us on air or online. What's your question on the cosmos, its shape, its motion? Do you see meaning in our new map? Join us anytime digitally at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. This conversation never ends. With us now from Pasadena, California, is Charles Lawrence, lead U.S. scientist for the Planck mission at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, where he has been studying cosmic microwave background. Charles Lawrence, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you with us. And with us from Kansas City is Sean Carroll, theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology, studies dark energy and general relativity, writes for Discover Magazine at the Cosmic Variance blog. His new book is The Particle at the End of the Universe. Sean Carroll, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
It's great to have you both with us. Charles Lawrence, first to you. How long has the Planck mission been ongoing, and what was it that came out last month? Was this a compilation of years of scans, months, decades? What?
Planck launched in 2009, the 14th of May, 2009, and it observed the sky continuously with two instruments, one of them for 29 months, and the other is still observing. The origin of the mission goes way back into the 1990s. It takes a long time to build a space mission.
And so this was a satellite, and it was observing what? What data was it collecting, Charles?
On the two instruments that are on Planck measure at 9 different wavelengths from 1 centimeter to a third of a millimeter. In frequency, that's 30 gigahertz to 857 gigahertz. And basically, we measure the whole sky, everything that's in the universe that's emitting at those frequencies or wavelengths. We just spin 1 revolution per minute, and we keep taking data. And every hour or so, we move the spin axis a bit, and in that way, we build up a scan of the whole sky.
And it's emitting what? Are we talking light, radio waves, microwaves, all of the above?
All of the above. Those are all just different names for electromagnetic radiation. Let's just call it light and different wavelengths. So we're measuring everything that's emitting light, radio waves, whatever, at those wavelengths in the universe. What Planck was built to study is, in particular, one component of that radiation. It's called the cosmic microwave background, and it's the oldest light in the universe, emitted just 370,000 years after the Big Bang. And that light has been traveling towards us from all directions for 13.8 billion years, basically in almost the entire age of the universe, minus the 370,000 years.
So out of all that survey, you get an age for the universe, a little bit older than we thought. You get a kind of a composition map. I'm reading here, 4.9% normal matter, whatever normal means, you'll tell us, 26.8% dark matter, 68.3% dark energy, and this news that the universe is lopsided. Some people have said chunky. It's not uniform in its what, the density of matter within it, Charles?
That's right. All of those things that you said are true. Let's take it a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the light that started out as a white-hot glow. Had there been any eyes to see it back then, just 370,000 years after the Big Bang, it would have been blindingly bright. But during the 13.8 billion years that the light has been traveling towards us, the universe has expanded by a factor of about 1,100, and that white-hot glow has cooled by the same factor to a cold glow that our eyes can't see. We build the instruments to see it. Now, what we're looking for in this light is tiny variations in the intensity of the light from place to place on the sky. Those variations are the result of sound waves that are traveling in this early universe. And there are a couple of things about that material that that you need to know. First, it was about 3,000 degrees on the Kelvin scale. That's a little bit hotter than a candle flame, a little bit hotter than an incandescent light bulb filament. At that temperature, everything was ionized, meaning that electrons and protons couldn't get together and form hydrogen. Two electrons and a helium nucleus couldn't get together and form a helium, a neutral helium atom. Everything was ionized. It was a plasma. And a plasma is opaque, like a candle flame. You can't see through it. Okay? Now, in this medium, we have sound waves. Sound waves that are excited by quantum fluctuations that happen really soon after the Big Bang. So a nanosecond.
Those sound waves you're talking about, were they the sound of the explosion of the Big Bang? Is that the right way to think about it or not?
No, they were. they're the sound of quantum fluctuations about a nanosecond after the Big Bang.
Okay.
And the way that they propagate through this medium tells us what it's made of, the density and its characteristics. So that's where we start to really learn stuff. If you've ever heard anybody talk after inhaling helium from a birthday balloon,
yes.
You know that
yes,
the medium course. That the sound is traveling through, yes, that makes a difference. And so now we can't hear this sound. We see it. Come to that in a minute.
Yep.
But by looking at that sound, we can tell the characteristics of the medium, and we can also tell what excited those sound waves in the beginning.
By the medium, now are you referring to the dark matter, normal matter, dark energy, or something else?
All of those. So we have normal matter, the kind of stuff that we're made out of, electrons, protons.
Which, of course, we call normal because it's us.
Because it's us, even though we're a distinct minority species. That's right. We're the little guys.
Yeah.
And then we have something called dark matter. We call it dark matter because it doesn't interact with light. It doesn't emit light. It doesn't absorb light. In fact, if we had a blob of it in front of us, we couldn't see that it was there at all. Light would just be going through it. Wouldn't make any difference. But
we probably do have a blob of it in front of us. So,
that's right. Maybe not right on our front lawn, but it has gravity. And so here we have two kinds of matter. One that has gravity and is affected by light, normal matter. And we got another kind, dark matter, that has gravity and isn't affected by light.
There's so much more I want to learn here, but if I may, Sean Carroll, I want to pull you in here. You know, we lay people listen to this with a kind of stunned amazement. It is not easy to take on board. You're understanding far more, no doubt, than I. So when all this data came out of the Planck mission, and we now have this clearer than ever vision of our universe, are these just tweaks in our understanding, Sean, or... I don't know. Have they led you to reorganize your life priorities?
My life priorities are not yet reorganized, but I'm keeping an open mind about the possibility of reorganizing them once we understand better.
I mean, does it? Of course, it matters. But then, does it matter, or is it just stuff out there that we can't ever affect? We're so puny in its face that it's simply beyond us, and it goes on its cosmic way whether we understand it or not.
Well, it doesn't matter for, how hungry you are or whether you're going to get to work on time or whether or not you're going to build a better iPhone, but it matters because we human beings work very hard to understand the universe that we're a part of. And we very much are a part of it. You know, we're made of the same stuff as the universe is made of. And as fascinating as the tiny puzzles and anomalies that the Planck satellite has brought us are, the point I like to emphasize is that we are on the right track, that we have...
Meaning what? Right track toward what?
Towards understanding the basic constituents and history of the universe. You know, I was once asked, aren't you cosmologists embarrassed that this ordinary matter that we're made of, stuff we understand, is only 5% of the universe, and there's 95% we don't understand? And I said, look, we understand 5% of the universe. That is amazing.
Yes.
I think it's incredibly impressive that we have a robust picture. You know, a million years from now, we will still believe that the universe is made of ordinary matter, dark matter, and dark energy, and people will say they figured that out in the last years of the 20th century, first years of the 21st.
So we're geniuses. If we figured it all out, would it bring about some cosmic moment, you know, like in a space odyssey? I mean, would that be, the, you know, I don't know, suddenly we go to some spiritual state, we disintegrate, does figuring it out mean it's all over, or is it really figurable?
Well, there's So the first point is we're not in any danger or prospect of figuring it all out any minute from now.
Okay.
What we do is we paint the broad stroke pictures that we've achieved now, and then we home in on them and get, you know, finer and finer details. And along the way, some of those details inevitably don't quite fit in and bug us for a little while, and then we realize, you know, holy crap, there's a whole nother way of thinking about things that is underlying this. So we have a picture that will stay there, but we'll get deeper, more and more deeply into it. And it will illuminate, you know, how the universe works, which is a pretty profound thing.
It all started with the Big Bang. It's expanding ever outward, but one day it will pause and start to go the other way.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, the sound of radio emissions picked up from Jupiter's largest moon, Ganymede, there, by NASA's Galileo in 1996. We're talking this hour about our lopsided universe, older, odder, and with more dark matter than we thought, according to the deepest scan yet of the cosmos. Charles Lawrence is with us from Pasadena, California. He is lead U.S. scientist for the Planck mission at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, co-chair of the Planck editorial board. They have been very, very busy unrolling their latest deep map of the universe, and we're looking at that in this hour. Sean Carroll's here from Kansas City today, theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology, author of The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of the World. Charles, you were talking about the lopsided or inconsistent kind of chunkiness of the universe. What does that matter to a scientist like yourself? What does it say to you? How does it change your sense of the cosmos?
One of the basic principles that seems to be true is that the universe is roughly the same everywhere. It is isotropic, as we say. But what we see is that one half is a little bit different than the other. The variations in this cosmic microwave background, in this earliest light, are a little bit bigger on one side of the sky than they are on the other.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what to make of that. It could be just random. Remember, these variations were excited by quantum fluctuations a nanosecond after the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they were just a little bit lopsided.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough lopsided that it just has to be something that was causing it to be lopsided. It looks like it could be just random, but we don't know. And that's going to be a source of thought for some years to come, I think.
Let me ask you, in this image that's come out from Planck, the map of the location of all matter in the universe, it looks like a big egg. Where are we in that? Or are we right in the middle because we're observing, we're the observer?
That's right. That egg is just the sphere spread out on a flat piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do the same thing with the Earth, you see North America on one side and Asia on the other side, but everything's in the same egg. It's a sphere unrolled on a flat surface. We're in the middle because we are seeing the light coming to us from all directions.
Okay, so which away is the more dense part, or are these clusters of density spread all over, the lopsided part?
Right. If you take a look at that image, the upper left part and the lower right part are the ones that are different. If you draw not a straight line, but divide the sphere in half with a line that cuts diagonally from upper right to lower left, the the large-scale variations in the upper left part are smaller than the large-scale variations in the lower right part. If you're looking at that now, you can kind of see that. But the difference is small. It's small.
Small, but everything matters. Sean,
yes.
Does it have an impact? Does it have like a different field of gravity? Is that why Picasso painted the ladies that way?
No, once again, you know, the universe is very big. And as you point out, if you're looking for personal ramifications of this, the ramification is that we are a very, very, very tiny part of the universe. And we theorists, I'm not, you know, an observer. I'm not the one who collects the photons and does the dirty work here.
Yep.
I get to sit back and think about what it all means.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to come up with models, you know, theories of the early universe that might account for why it seems lopsided like this. And I did that with a collaborator and a graduate student of mine, and our result was it's really hard to come up with a good theory that accounts for this kind of lopsidedness. So it's work for us, the theorists, to think carefully about it. It might be something absolutely world-changing. It might be, you know, a hint as to what happened before the Big Bang. It might be something absolutely boring, just a statistical fluctuation. So that's what we need to figure out.
You say something that happened before the Big Bang, and you have our attention right away. People
Good.
Think of that as the beginning of everything. So, you know, like somebody threw the cosmic bocce ball with a little spin on it.
Yeah, the thing is, we don't know. You know, we cosmologists, my colleagues and I, will sometimes tell you that nothing happened before the Big Bang. But the truth is that we don't know. The Big Bang is not the beginning of the universe. It's the end of our understanding of the universe. It might have been the very, very beginning. It might have been just a phase that the universe went through. So if there was something that came before the Big Bang and that something had some asymmetry, some difference from one part to another, then that might be reflected in the way that our universe came into being. So like I said, it could be really tremendously big news, or it could just be, we got lucky.
We're talking about our lopsided universe with Sean Carroll and Charles Lawrence. Larry's calling from Carthage, Missouri. Larry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. What's your question?
Well, you guys have actually kind of been working on answering it. I studied evolution and paleoanthropology in college, and specifically abiogenesis, or the creation of life from non-organic or non-living matter. And so my curiosity with the universe is much the same, talking about tracing it back to the single infinitely hot mass from which everything came as we understand it at this point. And I was just curious about, you know, would we ever be able to, you know, expand our understanding past that point, which you guys were just talking about? And if so, what kind of tools would we need to really look into that more deeply?
Let us pick it up. Charles Lawrence, you're in the middle of all this. Can we somehow look through this map to the other side of the bang? Is there anything in here that, any fibers that reach back beyond?
We can't see back with light because that early universe is opaque. We can go back further to the nanosecond after the Big Bang, potentially with something called gravitational waves, and also by inference of these fluctuations, these quantum fluctuations that produce the sound waves that we observe directly. Beyond that, no measurement has been thought up yet that could be made that could see beyond that barrier. And if Sean can come up with something that we can measure that would tell us about what happened before the Big Bang, I'd be happy to go out and try to measure it.
Sean, have you got a theoretical physics telescope with an extra little doodle on it that will look past that?
Well, I don't, but I think that Charles's word inference is the right one to use here.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we play this game is that we theorists, you know, the experimenters come with something we didn't expect. Like, the universe is lopsided. No one was predicting that very strongly ahead of time. And so we need to come up with a theory that would try to account for that, which is what I and my, you know, friends tried to do. And then once you have that theory, you make other predictions. Remember I said it's hard to do it. It's not hard to come up with a model that explains the lopsided universe. It's hard to come up with one that isn't already ruled out by other observations of galaxies and quasars and other features of the microwave background. So we don't have a good theory yet that I can tell Charles what to go look for, but believe me, we're trying.
Here's a question online. Dave Diamond asks, he says, since the starlight we see today is millions, or as you've got it there, billions of years old, I guess. How can we really know what's out there? Couldn't it all be gone by now? If this is 13 point whatever billion years old, Charles, is it still really there in some sense that we know or not?
Well, in terms of seeing the light directly, all we've got is what we can see that's been traveling for that 13.8 billion years. That's the edge of the universe that we can see. And by now, the stuff that emitted that light 13.8 billion years ago is much further away, 48, 49 billion light years away, and moving away fast. But one way to think about this is that we can see directly from the evidence that we have, that the universe is roughly the same everywhere. So think about something much more mundane. Imagine that a wagon left Philadelphia in 1773, mm-hmm. moving at a steady 10 miles per year.
Mm-hmm.
That's a slow snail pace.
Yep.
It was heading towards Los Angeles.
Okay.
In about 1800, it would be at Pittsburgh. In about 1850, it would be at Chicago. In about 1900, it would be in Omaha. 1950
okay.
in Denver, finally mm-hmm. in L.A. Along the way, it would be seeing the history of the United States as it developed from the Revolutionary War, different times for
right.
different places.
Mm-hmm.
So the light that we see that has come from the edge of the universe as we can see it has come past the different parts of the universe, different ages along the way. And we see the effect of the mass in the universe on the light as it comes past. So we can be pretty confident that these things are going on. We're sampling different times, different places, but there's still stuff out there everywhere.
And different things are showing up. I mean, by the time that wagon gets past, I don't know, somewhere headed down to L.A., suddenly cars go zooming by.
Something like that. Yeah, that's right.
I've got a little sound here that was put together using the data in your cosmic microwave background from the Planck mission. This was John Kramer, teaches physics at the University of Washington. He produced a little version here of what the Big Bang potentially sounded like. This must be very high concept, but let's listen and you can tell us what you hear in his interpretation. Here we go. Sean Carroll, are you kidding me? That just sounds like a cosmic raspberry. That's the Big Bang?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to be too curmudgeonly and overly pedantic here, but at the Big Bang, you wouldn't have heard anything. It was plasma of an incredibly high temperature, and you would have been incinerated to bits.
So what's being represented there? I mean, John Kramer at U Washington, you must know something about it. What do you pick up on there?
Well, the like Charles said, what we see in the temperature variations from point to point in the background radiation we observe, we know what those are. Those are the imprints of sound waves in the early universe. And those sound waves might have come from those very tiny fractions of a second right after the Big Bang. But the point is that by the time we're observing them, the wavelength of the sound waves is hundreds of thousands of light years. And so the frequency is very, very low, and you wouldn't have heard them for practical reasons anyway.
So it's trailing off
down.
Okay.
Well, the sound,
you scale it down.
Yeah, Charles?
The frequency of the sound would be 50 octaves below what he's representing there. So,
well, maybe that's still playing for all we know.
Yeah.
We would not know. John in Virginia Beach, Virginia. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling, not really so much a question, just more of a comment, as you were discussing the universe expanding and being slightly lopsided and having a hard time determining whether or not it was just a random event or,
yes.
or what caused it. Just kind of wanted to stick my two cents in there and encourage y'all to keep looking for reasons, because nothing happens randomly. To me, everything happens because of a reason. The only thing is a cause and effect in life. You know, some people say, that happened for this reason, so it was the means to an end. But instead, look at what made that happen to begin with, because that happens to be true in all of nature. And please don't get discouraged and think that there's too many variables to determine what was random. You figure out exactly what it was that made it that way, because something did, in fact, make that happen.
John, we'll pick it up. I don't think our guys sound discouraged here, but I don't know if they're if they fear randomness either. I mean, with our little 5% understanding of the cosmos, how do you look at randomness, Charles?
You heard John saying
nothing happens randomly.
One of the things that we observe is the statistics of these fluctuations. And what we see is that they are very, very, very close to random. So in that sense, we are watching something that is exquisitely random. On the other hand, we have now, with Planck and with other measurements, a very, very good understanding of what the universe is like, its geometry, its contents, its age, all of those things. We don't have the slightest idea why it's the way it is. So perhaps your listeners' search for meaning is in the why, but what we see is a result of a lot of random processes.
Sean, let me ask a question about that. We start to put these numbers on things, and it appears to be mapped. You know, Planck maps it in this lovely oval egg shape, and it looks finite. But yet I think we grow up being taught the cosmos is infinite, is infinite. Is it infinite, or is there an edge?
Well, I think both this question, is the universe finite or infinite, and this question, why did the universe come into existence in the first place, have the same answer, namely, we don't know. And that's okay to admit that we don't know. We don't see any edge or any finitude to the universe, but because we only see part of it, it might be finite or it might not be. It might have come into existence for a reason or it might be random. This is not something that we're allowed to impose on the universe. We have to look at it and keep an open mind and wait until we figure out what those answers are.
Charles, do your latest stats have you thinking infinity or finity?
Well, for me,
finitude.
I think real big.
But the idea of infinity is so beguiling. You know, as children, when we're taught it with that lovely little figure eight on its side, that notion of endlessness, when you look at the night sky, are you thinking that's real big or that's infinite, Charles?
I don't distinguish between those. It's so big compared to the Earth. It's so big compared to the solar system. So big compared to the Milky Way, and so big compared to the part that we can observe that light has had time to get to us from. That for practical purposes, it might as well be infinite. But there is a difference. I agree, and Sean has fun thinking about that difference in his professional life.
Practical purposes. Now, that's an idea to try and hold up against the grandeur of this scale, but we'll give it a shot. This is really interesting. I am loving this. Charles Lawrence, please stand by in Pasadena at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory there. And Sean Carroll in Kansas City, theoretical physicist out of the California Institute of Technology. We're talking about our lopsided universe, older, odder, and with more dark matter than we thought. Here's the ever-useful Monty Python with the Galaxy Song. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light-years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light-years thick. But out by us, it's just 3,000 light-years wide. We're 30,000 light-years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've got a couple of super physicists with us this hour talking about, well, nothing less than the universe. Here's a little bit of sound from out there, not that far. This is sound of NASA's Cassini spacecraft picked up on its mission to Saturn, been collecting data since 2004. Take us to space. Okay, I don't know exactly what that's supposed to be the sound of, but we've got it. We've got new data in from the Planck mission. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory works with them, and so does Charles Lawrence, who joins us today from Pasadena, California. And Sean Carroll is here, author of The Particle at the End of the Universe from the California Institute of Technology. Let's go right to our listeners, Daphne in Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Daphne. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question about a theoretical particle. I've just started Mr. Carroll's book, actually.
Great.
And this has nothing to do with it, but gravity is so different from all the other forces, and they are always looking for a graviton. I was wondering why they think that gravity has to have a particle.
Ooh, okay. Sean?
That's a perfectly fair question, and I hope you like the book. The point is that we haven't found this particle that we call the graviton, this hypothetical particle of gravity, but it's an absolutely solid prediction of everything we understand about both gravity and quantum mechanics. You know, gravity is the result of a field pervading the universe, a field that changes the geometry of space and time from place to place. And quantum mechanics says that when you have a field and you look at it very closely, you see individual particles, just like you see photons, particles of light, when you look at a light bulb carefully enough. So either gravitons exist or there is something that we thought we understood for the last 80 years perfectly well, and it turns out we don't understand it after all.
If there is a particle,
it's very difficult to ever know because gravitons are very, 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 very difficult to actually detect.
If they were there as particles, does that mean they would have mass, Sean?
No. Photons are particles, and they don't have mass. You know, a particle is just an individual packet of energy vibrating in some field. So particles that are massless just are particles that move at the speed of light, which is what a graviton would do.
Watch out. There goes one, or maybe not. Daphne, thank you. Melissa in North Augusta, South Carolina. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to ask you guys if you have any idea what you would think is beyond the map that came out from the Planck Institute.
And what are you suspecting, or what are you poking at there, Melissa?
Maybe the multiverse theory, or there being more than one universe.
Charles Lawrence, how about it? Something beyond your map, or maybe within your map, a multiverse that's overlaid that we don't see.
It's an appealing concept, and it excuse me, would account for one beginning. It's also true, though, that what's beyond what we can see now is more of same. And if we watch it, we'll see light that's coming from yet further away. So if we watch for the next billion years, we'll see this map change in detail, in the small details first, and then the larger structures later. And we'll still be seeing inside our universe. So what's outside our universe is a long way away if there's anything outside. And in fact, the whole concept of what's outside the universe is something that gives you a headache, maybe without any benefit.
Sean, take us to your theoretical physics platform here then. If we hear of the multiverse, the idea of, I guess, multiple universes, how ought we visualize that? If theoretically you're thinking along those lines, is that something that's within the geography of this map Planck shows us, or is the geography or dimensionality we look at here represented here meaningless in terms of a multiverse idea?
Well, the map that we've seen reveals a universe that looks fairly similar all over the place. The universe doesn't change dramatically from place to place. This lopsidedness we're talking about is a very tiny perspective effect. But we only see part of the universe. Are we seeing 10% of it, or are we seeing one kajillionth of it? And the answer is we don't know. So it is absolutely predicted by a lot of modern theories that if you go way beyond the universe we see, things begin to look very, very different. Different kinds of particles, different laws of physics, different numbers of dimensions of space. And that's the possibility of a multiverse. It's theoretically possible. If we're very lucky, we might even see some indirect evidence of it, because one sort of bubble universe next door might have bumped into us in the past and left a remnant signal in the microwave background that Charles is observing. So we're keeping our eyes peeled, but for right now, it's just an interesting idea that we're keeping in the back of our minds.
But you're suggesting in that if there's a multiverse, more than one universe, that they're not spatially overlapping? I think some people somehow imagine different manners of dimensionality, that the multiverse would all exist within the same spatial area?
Yeah, people imagine lots of things.
Well, I'm trying to take imagination toward your grounded theory.
That's right. So there's many different kinds of multiverse scenarios. And there are some that are, you know, multiverses of possibility suggested by quantum mechanics, or multiverses that are literally parallel, and the next multiverse, the next universe is less than a millimeter away from you, but in a direction in which you can't move. But there's also the idea that there's a multiverse in the sense of just different regions of space where conditions are very, very, very different. Then it's really just like a map of the Earth where you have oceans some places, plains other places, mountains other places. And we're looking at, you know, one square acre in the middle of Nebraska, and it looks pretty normal and uniform to us. But far away, things could look dramatically different.
That is some acre. Let's go to New Orleans and William. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's my understanding that the galaxies are moving away from each other, but also I hear that the Andromeda galaxy is going to collide with the Milky Way eventually. So how could that be?
The Andromeda galaxy will collide with the Milky Way. What do you say, Charles?
Yeah. The Andromeda galaxy and the Milky Way are part of a gravitationally bound system. And we see many examples of this. Clusters of galaxies could be hundreds, even thousands of galaxies that are gravitationally bound. They're not moving away from each other, and they won't. Gravity is holding them together. But on a large scale, from one cluster of galaxies to another cluster of galaxies far away, from one galaxy to another galaxy far away, they are moving away from each other in the general expansion of the universe. But where gravity controls, where you have enough concentration of mass to hold things together, doesn't move apart.
So even as things are spreading out from one another within that, they could have intersecting paths.
Yes. The solar system is gravitationally bound. Mm-hmm. The planets aren't moving away from the sun, and the 100 billion stars in the Milky Way aren't moving away from each other. They're gravitationally bound, so on.
All right, Jeff. So we may have to worry about the collision. I suppose that's on a time frame that hardly matters. On the other hand, we don't have to worry about it interrupting the theory of the case. Jeff in Sharon, Vermont. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Meet the Beth. A variation on a question that occurred a few minutes ago. To what degree do the gentlemen anticipate an adjustment of our understanding of time as having an important, being an important element of developing the model of what's going on?
The time factor. Charles, does it come into play here? Does what you've learned impact our understanding of time?
I don't think so, but let's see what Sean thinks.
What do you think, Sean, our theoretical physicist? What do you say?
Yeah, no, time is a fascination of mine. You know, I wrote another whole book about it. Mm-hmm. And I think actually that despite its forbidding reputation, we understand an awful lot about how time works. In fact, the single looming mystery that we don't understand is why the early universe started off in such a special, orderly state. You know, our early universe is like a cup of coffee and cream, where the cream is completely separated from the coffee, and over time it mixes together and increases in entropy and disorder. But why was it like that? I mean, it's the Big Bang conditions that really set the flow of time going in our universe, and that part is certainly a mystery. So maybe investigations like this will really give us some clues that will help us figure that out.
A listener asks online, Coast says, ask what the Planck data began to say in reply to the Fermi paradox, Sean. And what of the Eridanus supervoid? And what of the dark flow hypothesis, since gravitational anomalies may be more generally distributed than we remain actually aware? This from online.
You take the first part, Sean, and I'll take the last part.
Okay, that sounds good. You know, it says nothing at all about the Fermi paradox, which is the idea that it wouldn't be hard, if life were at all common in our galaxy, for us to have detected alien civilizations a long time ago. You know, we've been creating radio waves and putting them out into the universe for, 100 years, roughly? And we live in a galaxy that is over 10 billion years old. So there's plenty of time in the history of our galaxy for other civilizations to have arisen and made themselves known, and yet we don't see them out there. And the new Planck data, which confirm our general picture of the much bigger than our galaxy cosmos.
Yes.
Give us no clue whatsoever about why there's no alien civilizations that we've yet detected.
Charles, do you feel as lonely? Do we feel as lonely as ever, having looked at your map?
Well, we certainly don't detect any evidence of life in the cosmic background, but there are 100 billion galaxies in the universe, and on average 100 billion stars per galaxy, so that's a lot of stars to have planets and a lot of opportunities. Let me take up the dark flow question, a part of the question that was asked.
And begin with the definition, if you would. Dark flow?
Yes. Well, a previous caller asked a question about Andromeda galaxy coming towards the Milky Way and mm-hmm. galaxies moving apart. On a large scale, things are the motion of objects as big as galaxies is still controlled by gravity. And dark matter has gravity. So there's a question, is there a bunch of dark matter not too far away from us on a cosmic scale that is pulling things toward it in some way that we can detect? And from the Planck data, we don't see evidence for that. Some other groups have claimed from looking at previous data and probably will from Planck data that they do see it. It's a question of making measurements of quantities that are hard to measure and how accurately we can make them. The possibility that there's a big bunch of dark matter that's pulling stuff around, though, fits in perfectly with the overall concept. There is dark matter.
Sean, let's think about dark matter for a moment. Charles joked earlier that it's not right in our front yard, but I'm not too proud to say I have no idea if there's dark matter all around us right now or if it's in some distance from it. Does dark matter exist everywhere in our isotropic universe with or not, Sean?
Yeah, remember, Tom, I said if it was in our front yard, we couldn't see it.
Yes, okay. Okay,
that's right.
Fair enough.
Most of our theories right now say that dark matter is not only in your front yard, but in your body right now. There are dark matter particles passing through you, but because they're dark, which is a fancy physicist way of saying they don't interact very noticeably with the particles that we're made of, you don't know. They just go right through us. They go right through the Earth. We're passing through a wind of dark matter, and physicists are working very hard to build very sensitive experiments deep underground, shielded from radiation and noise and so forth, that will detect the occasional very rare dark matter particle bumping into them. So we think that we are swimming in a sea of dark matter. It's not perfectly smooth. There's more of it in the middle of the galaxy than in the outskirts, but it's definitely all around us.
The proportion of dark matter you've discovered through the Planck data, Charles, how's it shifted?
It went from 22.7 to 26.8% of what's called the critical density, the average density that would make the universe flat. So that's a pretty significant increase, 22.7 to 26.8%.
The implications of that for our understanding?
Well, there's more of it.
So
we're measuring the universe, and that's what we've got,
right? And dark energy.
That's down from 72.8% to 68.3%.
Okay.
Again,
does that mean we
density.
Should sell our shares in
sell? Well, you should have. It's too late now. Sorry, you missed that one, Tom.
Sean, the less dark energy than we knew as a proportion of what's going on out there. Maybe our so what questions are just so puny that their heads don't come above the parapet here. But so what? There's less dark energy. So what?
Well, so if you happen to be working on an elaborate theory of the composition of the universe, you now have a different target to aim for. In the case of dark energy, this is a moving target because as the universe expands, the dark energy and matter evolve very differently. But at least with dark matter, it's a fixed target. The dark matter is still matter. As the universe evolves, the ratio of dark matter to ordinary matter remains the same. So you can hope that you have a model of particle physics in the early universe that actually makes a prediction for what is the ratio of dark matter to ordinary matter. And maybe there's more than one kind of dark matter. Maybe there's 20 different kinds. Maybe there's dark atoms and dark chemistry and dark light. You know, there's a lot more dark matter out there than ordinary matter. We have a long way to go before we claim we understand it. So it's very, very good to get experimental data that tells us everything we can about how much of it there is.
Charles, your satellite presumably is still out there scanning away, picking up all this microwave background. But is there more to know, or have you pretty much got the picture?
We're still taking data with one of the instruments, and will be through September. What the results that we've released are based on 15 and a half months of data. We have 29 months of data from one instrument, and we'll have 50 months from the other. We have talked about the difference in temperature of the cosmic background, but we haven't talked yet about the polarization properties of that. Polarization, property of light, familiar from sunglasses that are polarized.
Mm-hmm.
And next year, in 2014, we'll be releasing results that are based on all of the data, including the polarization. What we expect then is a refinement of our numbers, better numbers. We get some more constraints. We'll have even more insight into it. And we will continue this remarkable understanding, remarkable increase in understanding. 404 years since Galileo realized that the Milky Way was made up of little points of light, which he inferred correctly were stars like the sun, so that the universe was bigger than the solar system. It's been less than 100 years since we understood the universe was bigger than the Milky Way. And here we have these incredible measurements that tell us some things to a fraction of a percent about the universe as a whole. It's the only time in history that this understanding will ever happen. And as you were saying, and Sean before, looking back on it from 100,000 years or a million years from now, this is the time we figured out how the universe was constructed.
Folks,
it's
amazing. There's your cosmos. There's where it stands. It is amazing. Charles Lawrence, thank you so much for being with us. And Sean Carroll, thanks to you both. There's your cosmos. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.